address the theme of the conference, which is emergent phenomena and effective theories, and also take the discussion in a different direction. I hope it's not seen too much as hijacking the agenda of the conference. But I have some questions which are philosophical questions and also scientific questions. And I actually, there's been some discussion about the difference between them. My view is that the best philosophical questions are also scientific questions, and the best scientific questions are also philosophical questions. So I want to ask some questions in this domain. This is also work partly based on a long project in collaboration with Roberto Mangabeira Unger, who is a very stimulating philosopher. Partly, well, it'll become clear, those of you who know of Roberto's work, what his contribution is. Now, some of the talks at this workshop have, it seems to me, and I mentioned this a few times, been complacent or naive about the notion of a fundamental theory. The notion of an emergent theory has been one which is defined at some larger length scale than the fundamental theory, but it's always been assumed, or it's been assumed not by everybody, but in many of the discussions, that there's a clear notion of what the fundamental theory is. And part of the purpose of this talk is to make you nervous about that. Because I am quite nervous about whether I know what a fundamental theory is and whether I know of anything which is not an effective theory, and whether I even believe that there could be a physical theory which is not an effective theory and not an emergent theory. Now, there are different notions of emergence that have gone around in the meeting, and I'm not going to try to solve the problem of the fact that we use different words, we use the same words to mean different things. But some people say emergent phenomena are novel, surprising, contingent, robust, protected, common to several systems with different microphysics, something we've thrown back and forth. They cannot be derived from fundamental theory or described in the language of a fundamental theory. And then there's a notion of emergent laws, which are laws that apply to emergent phenomena. And there's always been hanging around this notion that there's a fundamental law which underlies our understanding of nature. Now, one of the things that makes me nervous about this is that the progress of science is partly measured by moments when we realize that something that we thought was a fundamental law is really an emergent description. And that seems to happen over and over again. Let me give two connected examples. We used to think that the law of conservation of energy was fundamental and the law of conservation of momentum was fundamental. But if the fundamental theory is really general relativity, and whenever I say general relativity, I mean with cosmological boundary conditions, because I'm thinking a fundamental theory must be cosmological, there are no conservation laws whatsoever in general relativity with cosmological boundary conditions. Conservation laws, including energy and momentum, happen to be approximately the case when you study a solution of general relativity which is over some region approximately translation invariant in space or time. And so we have only an approximate notion of conservation of energy and momentum, which is contingent on there being a region of space-time where the curvature is small and the rates of change of the curvature are small. So does that make the conservation of energy and momentum emergent laws? I think there's a case to be made that. And then one goes one step forward. Many of us in this building are thinking about quantum gravity and have a picture in mind where the geometry of space and time is not fundamental, but some other description is fundamental in terms of graphs or matrices or operators in a quantum theory or spin foams or something like that. And we talk of the geometry of space-time emerging from a more fundamental description and general relativity as an effective field theory describing the emergent geometry. Now, are we misspeaking? There's one notational issue there because I think from the discussions this morning, from Margie's discussion and others, I'm not sure I'm using the word the right way. But I also really am mentioning this to emphasize that the things that we used to think of as fundamental theories, we now think of as emergent theories. And that could happen to general relativity and the standard model of particle physics, which are our most fundamental theories. One reason I'm interested, I'm confused about the distinction between fundamental and emergent theories is I'm interested in questions which are not answered when we think we know what the fundamental theory is. And I think there are questions about nature that are not answered when we specify what the fundamental theory is. And in the interest of a complete account, I like to refer to Leibniz's principle of sufficient reason, which is really a demand for doing good science and giving complete explanation. There are questions about nature which are not answered, and therefore our science is not as good as it might be. One of these questions is, why is X the fundamental law of physics rather than some other fundamental law of physics? Another question is, why were the initial conditions in the very early universe what they were and not different? There's a lot to say about those questions, but let me emphasize that we're really at the limits of, it won't help to have a more fundamental theory because we'll always come back to these questions. And one way I understand this is that what's under threat here is the strategy of reductionism. Reductionism is great and powerful as a strategy to explain composite systems in terms of properties of the things they're made of. But if we believe that there's a level of most elementary particles, they have properties, what strategy are we going to use to understand what their properties are? We need a new strategy. Okay. I said that. There's a more specific way that I try to get at the question of what's a fundamental law, and that's by talking about a schema or a paradigm for fundamental laws, which all the things that are or have been thought to be fundamental laws since Newton's time fit into, and we call this the Newtonian paradigm. A theory is in the Newtonian paradigm if it has a space of states, which doesn't evolve as the system evolves, so a space of possible states, which in some sense is specified for all time as timeless, and then a law which tells you how the states evolve on that space of states. And Newtonian mechanics, general relativity, quantum field theory, cellular automata, et cetera, all fit in this paradigm. This paradigm depends on an absolute distinction between what's the role in an explanation of law and what's the explanation of the role, what's the role of the initial conditions in the explanation? And this absolute distinction between the law and the state, or the role of the law and the role of the initial conditions, is operationalized in the way that we verify that laws are true, the way that we deduce them from experiment. And several people have correctly pointed out in this meeting that everything we do relies on experiment. Because look, what we do is we define a system that we're studying, which is some little small subsystem of the universe. We describe the space of states, the degrees of freedom that we're interested in studying, and then we study how the system evolves starting from different starting points. So we study operationally how the dynamics of the system depends on the initial states by studying it over and over again with different initial states, and therefore we operationally distinguish between the role of the states and the initial states and the role of the law. The law is the aspects of the dynamics that are true in all the instances of the system. Okay. So let's just keep that framework in mind. I'll come back to it. Now, if that applies to all the laws that we think of as fundamental, let me note that no law that schema applies to, I would claim, and I'm sure that people will disagree with me, but no law that schema can apply to can be an exact law. Here's the argument. Okay. I just said that to operationally test such a law and see if the thing that's called the dynamics is really the dynamics, you have to apply it to many instances of the system. But that means that each instance that you're studying is a small part of the history of the universe, because there have to be many of them to study. Okay. That means that each has been defined to be an isolated system by some approximation where you said you weren't interested in the influence of the rest of the universe on that subsystem. And there are no truly isolated systems in nature. Even your best experimentalists can't get rid of the influence of gravitational waves coming through your apparatus. as well as things coming in, you know, the white swans or the black swans coming in from down your light cone. So no system, so this is a fiction. It's a very useful fiction, but it's a fiction. No system is truly an isolated system, except perhaps the universe as a whole. And therefore, every application of this schema or paradigm for theories is approximate. Okay. Only a cosmological theory that includes all the effects on all the subsystems could be an exact description. However, something goes badly wrong when we try to just, the natural thing to do when we come to study cosmology and try to make a complete physical theory is to just do the same thing again, but put in the space of states or the Hilbert space, quote, the whole universe. Okay. But then several things go wrong. One of the things that goes wrong is you just now have one case that you're studying. And therefore, you have no operational way to realize the distinction or to ask the question, what's the role of the initial conditions versus what's the role of the dynamical law? Another thing that goes wrong is that the questions I raised at the beginning are definitely unanswerable. The question of why these laws and why these initial conditions and so forth. And I realize, I'm on the wrong slide here. I'm a little bit out of order in my argument. So let me just make the finish this argument, then I'll come back to what's on the slide. So when you apply this framework for physics, which includes general relativity, to the universe as a whole and try to do serious cosmology, classically or quantum mechanically, you can't address the question of why this is law is the right law and why the solution with the initial conditions is the right initial conditions. Okay. Now, there's another thing that goes wrong, which is that if you really believe that the universe is described by a system in this, organized in this way, with a timeless space of states and a timeless dynamical law, then time really disappears from your description of nature. And there are several ways to see this. There are several arguments. Within general relativity, you are led to the block universe picture, and then you're led by the question of what's an observable, what's an invariant, to argue that what's really, really real is the whole history of the universe, not the universe at any moment. Another way to say that is that any observable which measures something happening, quote, at some time, by which you might mean some clock reading, can be re-expressed by using the equations of motion as a property of the initial conditions. So there's nothing that ever happens that's not just a property of the initial conditions. And we see this in spades when time disappears in the equations of quantum cosmology. Okay. Now, a little interlude into some history. This disappearance of time troubles some people and is celebrated by other people. And one of the people that this troubled, apparently, was Einstein, although he's usually regarded as having celebrated the block universe in the absence of time. And here is a quote from Carnap, a very influential logical positivist and philosopher, from his autobiography that I imagine the philosophers in the audience know. I think, Jim, you told me about this. That, and I won't read the whole thing, but basically they went drinking one night and Einstein said he was troubled by the fact that the notion of the now or the present moment has disappeared from physics. And Carnap said, basically, this guy is a fool. He doesn't understand that science is about, science is not about our experience, science is about reality, and reality by definition is what's really true, and truth is timeless, so there's no issue. And any question that can be asked of an experiment can be coded in general relativity, so why is Einstein worrying about that? Well, I used to think Carnap was right, and I've come to think that Einstein is right, partly because of... So here, I just made the argument in the wrong order. Here's what... Why I'm troubled by the elimination of time from physics. One is that puts us in a situation where we have no hope of explaining the why these laws or why these initial conditions problem. And that statement is a whole argument in itself, so I won't give that. But I think we are cut off from any possibility of solving those problems. Another issue is that, look, what are we doing? General relativity has an infinite number of solutions, as does any theory organized the way that I described and called the Newtonian paradigm. If such is the description of the universe, then there's something extravagantly sloppy and wasteful about the organization of our scientific theory, because only one of those solutions actually describes the real world. Only one of them actually happens. So why do we have a theory that generates predictions about an infinite number of cases that never will happen? There's no problem with that if we have a theory which is describing small parts of the universe, because they come in many copies, so we need many solutions. But why should a cosmological theory have an infinite number of solutions? So how can we have, and therefore, by the way, if there's not a distinction that the theory gives us between the real world and an infinite number of possible worlds, we haven't solved the why these initial conditions problem. Now, how do we have any hope of scientifically addressing the question of what chose the laws and what chose the initial conditions? And I am coming back, winding my way back to reductionism, don't worry, to reductionism and hence to emergence and the distinction between emergence and fundamental. How do we have any hope of addressing scientifically? And by scientifically, I mean within a hypothesis that will make predictions for yet not yet observed phenomena by which it could be strongly confirmed or falsified. Otherwise, we're just making stuff up. Okay. Well, after a lot of reflection, and again, I'm cramming a lot into this half an hour, after a lot of reflection, Charles Sanders Peirce was right about this. He reflected on exactly this issue in the 1890s, 1880s, and 1890s. And I will read this because I think that this is a key quote for the future of cosmology. To suppose universal nature, universal laws of nature capable of being apprehended by the mind, and yet having no reason for their special form, but standing inexplicable and irrational, is hardly a justifiable position. Uniformities are precisely the sort of facts that need to be accounted for. Law is par excellence the thing that wants a reason. The only possible way of accounting for the laws of nature and for uniformity in general is to suppose them the results of evolution. Now, come see me after the talk. Don't object now, but come see me after the talk if you think you have a way to answer why these laws are the laws without Peirce's solution. Peirce's solution is that there has to be an evolution of laws. If there's an evolution of laws, then time is more fundamental than law. Therefore, the block universe is wrong because time cannot, in quantum cosmology and the wave function of the universe and all that stuff is wrong because time cannot emerge from law if law is evolving, because there needs to be a time for law to evolve in. Therefore, that's my next slide, which I'm coming to. If there is a law by which laws evolve, let's call it the meta law. And then there is what's called the meta law dilemma. Peirce says laws must evolve to be explained, but what governs the evolution of laws? Here's the dilemma. Either the evolution of laws is law-like, in which case it's governed by a law, in which case you could ask why that meta-law, or it's not law-like, in which case there's a fundamental irrationality and end to our understanding. Okay. That's what we call, with Roberto Unger, the meta-law dilemma. I think that the future of cosmology as a science depends on resolving this. So in the last couple of minutes that I have, I'm going to just mention some ideas addressed to resolving the metalaw dilemma, and they come back to the issue between of emergence. So I'm winding my way now back to emergence, because emergence plays a role here. Here are two ideas out of several that you might play with. One is, maybe there's a notion of universality of metalaw. In computer science, you don't worry about what's the computer that you're running your software on, because there's a notion of universality. All computers are formally equivalent. Maybe if you wrote down what you wanted a metalaw to do, there would be a theory that told you there was a formal equivalence, and any metalaw was equivalent to any other metalaw, and it wouldn't make sense to investigate as a scientific empirical question what is the actual metalaw. Okay, so hold that thought. And the second one is that if you're going beyond this Newtonian framework and Newtonian paradigm, how are you going to go beyond it and still stay within something well-defined? Well, the Newtonian paradigm is based on a clean distinction between the notion of a state and the notion of a dynamical law. Maybe that can break down. And the idea here is that maybe they work together. Maybe there would be a metalaw which would be universal and therefore generic, and it would operate on an object which gave you information about a metastate, some of which would be what we usually call the law. That is, there would be a part which was changing very slowly, and we could call the law, which acted on a part which changed very fast, which we could call the state temporarily. And I think I have just like 3 minutes or something. 4 minutes. So I think, so in the 4 minutes, because I'm a physicist and I want to show something concrete, I'll show a simple model that realizes these ideas. I'll conjecture a property of the model, which the experts can jump on me, and I will not claim I have strong evidence for, but I have some evidence for, and then I'll close. Okay. So why we're coming back to emergence is that I'm saying that the emergence that we should be looking forward to and thinking about is emergence of the notion of law and the distinction between the law and the state. So that, okay, here's a little model. It's a dumb toy. What I'm going to call the metastates of the system are really big matrices. And really big matrices are things that physicists play with all the time when we want a general setting for some dynamical system. These matrices happen to be anti-symmetric and have entries which are integers. But that's not that actually that important. Okay. I want to propose or to study a metalaw on this, which will be determined by some simple ideas about an update rule. So I'm thinking sort of computer science-y. Okay. So what do I want for my criteria for a general dynamical system on big matrices? One is I want an update rule which is second order, so that I have a sequence of matrices x0, x1, x2, xn. And xn is some function of xn minus 1 going one step back and xn minus 2 going two steps back. Why do I want that? Because laws of physics in physics are second order. So I want something that requires two initial conditions to march forward. Okay. I want stability. So I want the world to have fixed points. So I want if the one back and the one back before that are the same, I want the next one to be the same too. So that gives me stability and the possibility that there are fixed points in this evolution. Now, I want the dynamics to be nonlinear, because dynamics is nonlinear in nature. We couldn't live in a world without interactions. But there's a trick that people who play with matrix models know, which is that you can always reduce the order of a nonlinear theory, of a nonlinear equation, by adding spurious extra auxiliary degrees of freedom. You can always make your matrix bigger by just putting in, you know, the way that you go from Newton's laws to Hamiltonian mechanics, you define P as x dot, and then you find a first order equation, et cetera, by doubling the degrees of freedom. You can always do that, and you can always reduce a nonlinear equation for matrices to a quadratic equation by making the matrices bigger and bigger and bigger. So I'm going to assume that that's been done. Okay. Again, this is sort of towards the notion of universality. And I'm going to assume once that's done that the nonlinearities are as small as possible. And finally, I'm going to ask that the linear part is time reversal invariant. And those criteria give me a unique update rule, which is that one there. Okay. So I yes, and we can talk about that afterwards. If you stick 17 here, you lose the time reversal invariance of the linear part. I'll show you that later. You do. And if you stick anything other than 1 here, you don't have the smallest nonlinearity. Yes? You recognize these equations and you know all about them? Can we talk?
No, I just want to say, to me, these criteria look like laws, especially the first one.
I'm searching.
It's Newton's law.
Let me show you. Let me conjecture what the prop. Let me show you what the property is I'm interested in. Okay. The property I'm interested in is that one can separate out a piece that is slowly changing and a piece of these matrices that changes fast, and the thing that changes fast. Oh, let me just call it rho, and then I'll tell you what it is. Changes by commutators with the part that changes slowly, which I'm calling H. Okay. And I think I have several slides of detail, which I'm going to suppress, because I think I'm out of time. But one can choose the population of these matrices such that, and I'll just say what the choices are. The choices are that the initial matrix, which becomes the Hamiltonian, lives in an ensemble of matrices, which, were they adjacency matrices of graphs, would be at the phase transition between connected and disconnected, for people who know what that means. And the change from that, from the first one to the second one, is small compared to that. And then you can show that the changes, the subsequent changes, rho, are the changes xn to xn minus 1, and h is the initial choice, that the subsequent ones evolve as if there's a slowly changing Hamiltonian, which is changing quickly a state. It's changing more quickly a state. And that lasts for a number of time steps, which is roughly like the size of the matrices. And then it breaks down. Okay. Let me jump through. I had a bunch more to say. But let me just close by some questions. If general relativity is true, then the laws, I'm coming back to this argument, then the law of conservation of energy is emergent. And by true, I mean applies to a cosmological context where there's compact or cosmological boundary conditions. But if there's some unification of general relativity in quantum mechanics and the rest of physics, then general relativity also is emergent. And I understand that there are different senses of emergent, but I think that I'm using the word consistent with at least some of those senses when I say that the law of conservation of energy is emergent if general relativity is true, and that general relativity is emergent if quantum gravity is true. But even if quantum gravity is true, it could come in many different forms. The laws of particle physics could come in many different forms. At some point, we seek not just what is the fundamental theory, but an explanation for what is the fundamental theory. And the collection of arguments that I put together, and I understand I'm going through them very quickly here, all point to two things. One of them is that two of the basic notions that I think we assume in most discussions of physics are breaking down. One of them is the distinction between what's fundamental and what's effective or emergent, and the other is the distinction between what's a dynamical law and what's a state is breaking down. And let me stop there, and thank you. And let me just say, because this is the, I have the bad luck to be the last talk of the conference, but let me just close by saying the idea of this conference was an experiment. The idea was to get some philosophers who were very knowledgeable and conversant with issues of emergence, in mostly in the context of statistical physics, together with some physicists, especially some statistical physicists and condensed matter physicists who work in that area, although we threw in a little spicing on the side of some other kinds of physicists, and see if we would have a lot to say to each other. And I've been very stimulated by the meeting, and my sense is that we have a lot to learn about how to talk with each other, but I would judge that the experiment is successful. So thanks, everybody, for their time and attention.
So we have a general question period for the two speakers now. So feel free to direct your questions at either one.
Yeah, I have a question for Bhaskaran. So, so you said that there are all sorts of gauge fields or type of particles that can emerge from a spin liquid or other condensed matter systems, and you mentioned the Z2 field, the U1 field, and fermions. Is there any obstruction or principle to the emergence of any kind of possible gauge field or particle from a condensed matter model, or everything in principle can?
No. We have a few examples. So we are learning through simple examples on square lattice, honeycomb lattice, carbon lattice, and surprising things happen. So far, there is no guiding principle to look for, let's say, some issue, some new emergent. No, definitely not. But there are many, many already quite rich for trying to explore and understand what's going on. Have I understood your question?
So you're saying that there is no obstruction in principle, but you also don't know if it's possible to make a merge whatever you want, right?
For example, going away from simple two-level systems, if you go to many-level system, like there were some talks about SU N spin. Then you start getting some other objects.
Right.
So probably you can get many things. I do not know if it is exhaustive. Like you can get anything that you want.
Okay. So yeah, for Lee, two of the things that in my career lifetime come as answers to these questions is, one is there will be some logical principle that forces the ultimate meta law to be true. This seemed to be the promise of string theory in the 1980s, though I think they retreated. The other is that all logically admissible structures are physically instantiated, which is basically the ultimate multiverse. You didn't mention either of them, so I'm assuming you don't like them very much, but would you want to comment on those?
I think the first one we've tried, and not just in the 80s, but in the 90s with looking for M theory. And for the second one, that's my next slide. So let me just briefly say, one person who's put the case very strongly is Max Tegmark, and what he calls the mathematical universe hypothesis. And one way to say that is that there exists a mathematical object, I'll call it O, which is isomorphic to the history of the universe in the sense that every true property of the universe, everything that's true about the physical universe, has a corresponding mathematical theorem or fact about the mathematical object O. This implies that any property of the universe is deducible by logical deduction, which is what you're implying from O. And that, I think, there's a little slippage that we do all the time in physicists when we imagine that there's a fundamental theory, which is we imagine that causation is going to be explained by logical implication in some timeless domain. And I've become very critical of that. Here, basically, there are a long list of reasons I think that to go in this direction is a cop out, and doesn't.
You mean the multiverse direction?
Well, this. There are different reasons for different versions of the multiverse, but I don't think that that there is such a mathematical object. I don't think there is such an isomorphism. One reason I don't think that is that I think the real world has a property that no mathematical object has, which is that it's always some present moment. And there's a long list of other reasons. So let me stop with that. My question on the slide here, which is really a question to all of us, is, and this is sort of about how radical is the notion of emergent phenomena and emergent law. If there is phenomena which are which satisfy the definition of emergence, which is not derivable, not specifiable, not describable, I forget the three categories that Margie used there, but not derivable from the fundamental law being this mathematical object O, then that stands as a refutation of this view. So if we believe that there are emergent phenomena that satisfy that definition of emergence, then that refutes the view that there could be a mathematical object that has all the properties, that has properties isomorphic to all the properties of nature.
So this is a question for Lee, but I think it's just a point of clarification. I wasn't quite clear about when you were giving your examples at the very end about conservation of energy and GR being emergent. So GR is emergent if quantum gravity is true. What's the distinction there between emergence and just thinking of these as approximations? So why wouldn't you say, well, GR is an approximate theory if quantum gravity is true? So what's the characterization for calling it emergent as opposed to just an approximation?
So let's go through the things that a phenomenon has to be emergent, okay? And we'll see if I've learned anything from this conference. It should be applicable at a much larger scale, a different domain of phenomena. Okay, that checks. Classical general relativity would be believed to hold. And I'll take as an example derivations that pull approximate general relativity as an approximation from spin foam models. Two, robustness that is many different, and this might be the case, we don't know, but might be the case, many different microscopic theories would give rise to the same classical space-time description, the same approximate law of general relativity, independence of the ontological objects. There's nothing like continuous space-time in these discrete pictures, in these discrete quantum gravity models. They are they're defined on sets of graphs, and they give quantum amplitudes to sets of graphs. So I think that this deserves to be studied in some detail, especially if the ambition works. But I think that some of the criteria that you said are applicable to emergent theory. That is, and you know, as far as surprise, so there's only, one can't put oneself in the position of, suppose we lived in a world described by quantum gravity, would we be surprised if there was a regime of phenomena described by the Einstein equation? I don't know that there's an honest way to ask that question.
Yeah. So I was intrigued by the Pierce quote and the word evolution in it, which could mean changing over time and could mean something more Darwinian. And I know you've explored both versions. Is it clear? Do we understand exactly what Pierce meant by evolution?
I think I'll defer to one of the scholars in the audience about that.
Okay.
Bill?
A purse. What do you mean by time versus some more general notion of evolution?
Well, you could imagine just changing over time, which is the sort of physicist.
Changing what?
Or you, changing over time, evolving in that sense. Or you could mean something like survival of the fittest in the Darwinian sense.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Or you could mean something else, something entirely different from both. But.
I'm not sure. I don't want to commit.
Yeah. Marcy, do you want
to? Well, where's that this idea of what is going to be true in the limit? And the limit is the thing that we reach. It's kind of a fictional world, but he really thought that we were progressing toward this limit.
So the limit counts as the ideal state of knowledge. So quite literally, there is a kind of evolution here. Where we're gaining more and more and more and more knowledge until we get to this limit where actually everything is true. And then there's been a lot of debate about, you know, is this something that we thought could be actually realized, or is it something that just first just kind of invented to make sense of the notion that, you know, at some point inquiry ends, but for now it's just going on and on and on. So it's a kind of, it's an evolutionary notion, but it's one that has an end point to it. So it's goal directed in that way.
So I might be the only one, but I think we made huge progress in cosmology over the last years, the last 20 years or so. And this whole statement that, you know, we cannot use our present laws to describe the universe as a whole, I don't quite understand the problem. It seems to work out very nice. I mean,
it's a very good point. Thank you, Silke. Thank you for the question. I think there's a difference between doing astrophysics on a larger scale that we can observe, which is what I would claim we've been doing, and claiming that we have, quote, a theory of cosmology, a theory of all that exists. And I think there's a huge difference between those. And we have done the first extremely successfully, extraordinarily successfully, and so successfully that we speak longingly of doing the second. And part of what I'm trying to communicate is that we have to rethink, if we really have the claim that we're going to be doing physics on a scale of a closed system, which is the whole universe, we have to rethink the methodology of physics, because the methodology of physics, not surprisingly, is fantastically well adapted to studying parts of a larger world.
Again, on your books of classical mechanics, classical Newtonian mechanics, is it an emergent theory, according to your current view?
You mean emergent from quantum mechanics?
From quantum mechanics, yeah.
I don't know. I'm confused about that.
Oh, so then you didn't let me ask the second question, which was whatever you take on quantization. So then what is quantization, classical theory, again, within this framework?
But I don't think there are a lot of questions that I'm not attempting to answer. And one of them is, look, we believe that at least for, you know, limited systems, delimited systems, quantum mechanics is the right description. Okay. Again, for reasons that are related to this argument, I no longer believe that there is a quantum cosmology, the theory that the Hilbert space is the right domain to talk about, quote, the universe as a whole. Okay. But quantum mechanics is a very accurate description, at least accurate to a good approximation, for all the subsystems that we've studied. Okay. Classical mechanics, and this is where I think the question that Margie is asking, classical mechanics is explicable as an approximation to quantum mechanics. Is it genuinely, does it satisfy the genuine criteria of emergence? I'm not sure. I mean, now the our colleagues here have given us some criteria for emergence, and we go through them. And we can go through them, but maybe not right here in the present, in the moment.
I have a simple question, or comment, and a question. Comment is, I'm wondering, I guess it's also a question. why do you emphasize so much the loss of energy and momentum conservation laws in cosmology? I mean, the Einstein equations, classically taken, still have decomposed into constraint and evolution equations, and the constraints are preserved and they're conserved, and they actually play a role, you know, closely related to energy, momentum, and conservation. So I just didn't understand why you emphasize so much the loss of energy, momentum, and conservation laws. But rather than spending time with your answer to that, why don't we just take that as my comment reacting to you?
Okay.
Let me ask you a more interesting question. You didn't comment at all about the wave function of the universe as a kind of instantiation of this idea of blending of the law and the state. And so, I mean, if somebody's willing to give us the wave function of the universe and say, this is the right one, however they cooked it up, it's all you need. It contains, it seems to me, the laws in it and the state in it, and it has everything. And so I'm interested in what you think about that as an example of what you're talking about.
So what you're saying is correct. Okay. It's not a resolution. However, two howevers, which to me are important, may not be important to you if you sought to reformulate physics that way, but are important to me. One of them is I don't believe anymore, even if I have motive not to believe, I also don't believe in points of detail, the case that, quote, space-time evolves from typical wave functions of the universe. Okay. And the second is that if you are doing conventional quantum mechanics, the wave function of the universe lives in a Hilbert space, you're shaking your head. So you have something in mind which is not conventional quantum mechanics. And then if it doesn't live in a Hilbert space, you have to tell me where the probability interpretation
right.
comes from. And I think that's a road that you don't come back from, but you may disagree.
Well, I used to reject it out of hand, but as time goes on, I'm more and more sympathetic to the idea that you just kind of dig into that wave function and figure it out. It's all built in. Whatever structure is in that wave function, probability is sort of emergent. Space-time is emergent.
See, there
Hertog,
we go again.
Hertog, Hartle, and Hawking recently tried to put some meat on that idea in terms of how you actually use it to make predictions. I'm not sure it makes sense at all.
I don't think
But I'm
it does.
Also not sure that it doesn't make sense. And it's so close to what we have and yet stepped so far away at the same time that I find it an interesting point of departure for thinking about the kind of question you're raising.
Yeah, it's worthy of being thought about. I'll agree with that. I'm not very inclined to think that that's the right way to go for a whole bunch of reasons. I don't think that quantum mechanics itself is applicable, but you're going to tell me it's not quantum mechanics, you're doing something else. So certainly the burden is on you to flesh it out. I don't think the time emerges. I don't actually think the probability emerges if you don't put it in, that is, if you don't put the Hilbert space norm in. And finally, if you're not telling me that this quantum state is the solution of the quantum constraint equations, then where did you get it from?
Path integral
with a measure. No. But that's achieved. The path integral with some measure and boundary and analyticity conditions.
Yeah.
All the specification of which, when you dig down deep, is either really the specification of this, you know, the details of the state, or is the specification of the inner product. But anyway, good luck. And not that I think that the program that I'm set out on is not very hazardous, but
just two very quick comments concerning the why the loads question. For one of them, you are saying that you want to create meta loads or whatever, which I think was already discussed. Like, it's already a load. Even if it is lowless, it seems to me that imposing no load is also kind of imposing load, which is no. So that's the first one. The second comment is also that you're saying that as even if we go just as deep as possible and we end up with the final sets of laws, you are assuming that this is not going to answer the question why there are laws. This is actually making an assumption on the actual laws you will end up to, even though you don't know those laws.
Sure, but I
I mean,
it may not seem like it, but I'm actually very limited in my aspirations for this work. My whole aspiration for this work is to push science a little bit forward, say to go from the first 3 minutes after the Big Bang to go from the first 3 minutes before. There's a whole list of questions that I'm going to duck, including those.
Okay, let's have the last question.
A couple of things that might relate to this as well, but one of the things you mentioned earlier was that one of the problems in general relativity is that, in a sense, everything was in the initial conditions, that you could re-describe everything as just functions of the initial conditions. Now, even with time, you basically get that. If you have the dynamics, etc., everything gets expressed in terms of initial conditions. Slightly different in general relativity. But as soon as one gets quantum mechanics, that's no longer true. I mean, as Aronoff has been one of the key people to point out, other people have as well, including me, that once you get quantum mechanics in there, future conditions and past conditions are no longer equivalent to each other. That there is, in a sense, a division point of the now which separates out how one treats conditions that you put on in the future and conditions that you put on in the past, and that they are the outcomes of these are extremely different, very different from anything that our intuition has been developed by the whole sort of initial value kind of formulation of most physical theories. And, you know, well, let me just throw that out as a comment question.
Let me take that somewhere which I think I can take usefully. What Aronoff is doing and you are doing with that stuff is really investigating the issue of time reversibility of the laws of nature. And
it's actually more than that. It's that within quantum mechanics, within any theory, one always puts conditions on in order to specify the theory into a situation we want to look at. And that within quantum mechanics, future conditions, which are perfectly straightforward, we do it all the time, and past conditions play very different roles. And one can place both incompatible future and past conditions on a system, which lead to predictions for the present, which are very different from what you would get, for example, by just putting on past conditions. Past conditions, for example, in quantum mechanics can always be replaced by a wave function. Future mm-hmm. conditions and past conditions mm-hmm. can't. Now, Aronoff replaces it by sort of a thing he calls a double wave function, one from the future and one from the past. But that's, whatever it is, it's very different from what you get from the sort of thinking of, you know, evolution from initial conditions.
Let me tell you what I understand about this and frame it as a question back to you. Okay. The dynamics that we understand for all these different cases are time reversal invariant. The universe as we observe it is very asymmetric with respect to time. Okay. If you believe in a black universe picture, there must be some place where you put the explanation for why the universe is so asymmetric in time. For example, why there are no solutions of Maxwell's equations where you wave a charge around and the light rays propagate into the past rather than propagate into the future, the advanced solutions rather than the retarded solutions. We put, in electrodynamics, in general relativity, in field theory, we put the whole burden on explaining why the future is different from the past on the choice of initial conditions. We impose very special initial conditions to rule out solutions of either general relativity or Maxwell theory, where it would appear as if light was propagating from present excitations into the past. So the same issue certainly arises in quantum mechanics. Are you saying the resolution in quantum mechanics is different?
The comment is a completely different comment from that one. So
I see. Then I'm misunderstanding.
I mean, it doesn't have to do anything. I mean, the Hamiltonian could be such that the system isn't time symmetric, time dependent Hamiltonians, and so forth. And this whole thing still goes through. But basically, that there's a difference between the now and the future and the past. The future and the past play more or less symmetrical roles in Aronoff's picture, but that the now operates very differently, and it depends on the relationship in time to the now as to how the conditions in the future, which is obviously a relation to now, and to the past affect the observations that you make in the present.
Yeah.
So is much more the emphasis that we've been placing on this funny feature of quantum mechanics.
Okay, I would say the same thing as you said. I mean, the view that I hope to develop is that there simply is a present, and the present evolves into the future from the past, and therefore the future is very different from the past, and the present is different from either of them because the present is what actually exists.
Okay, before we think speakers, this afternoon, I want to remind you